That is your audience.
Okay. We've got a lot of media savvy types that are going to be ready. So we're talking radio, TV, print. We get a few movie buffs. We get a few. We get some quite artistic people. But mainly we get like pretty media savvy people.
Okay.
And I mean, all sorts of people. We get some what some people would refer to as controversial people. We also get people which are very much toe the company line sort of stuff. So that's sort of the audience. Right, no dramas, we'll string into it. This is Greg Single reporting for Media Man Australia. We're speaking with the well-known Australian media figure, Mr. Philip Adams. Welcome to the program.
G'day.
So tell me, describe your journalistic style, Philip.
Good heavens above, you don't expect me to do that.
Why?
Well, it's idiosyncratic, eccentric, personal. I never write a word, I dictate everything, so it's conversational, accessible, funny, angry, all sorts of things, depending on the mood of the I'm in or the issue I'm confronting.
It certainly is, just based on your answer alone, there is no doubt in the world about that. So do tell me, what are some of the interviews and quotes that really put you on the Australian media map?
Well, it wasn't interviews that put me on the map. I started writing columns for... You can edit this later, can't you?
Yes.
Okay. Look, I've been doing newspaper stuff now for 50 years, which is probably something of a record.
I think so.
So you must submit me to the Guinness Book.
Yes.
I started off writing for a communist newspaper when I was 15, called The Guardian, long since deceased. I then started writing pieces for The Bulletin, long before Sir Frank Packer owned it. And I had to stand in for tired and emotional journalists who were too pissed to do whatever it was the Bulletin asked them to do, so I'd do it for them, for practice.
Yeah.
Then I was persuaded to go to The Australian by the cartoonist Bruce Petty in the early days of the Oz.
Right.
And I started writing columns about things that people didn't write columns about in newspapers. I started writing.
And why was that? Why didn't they write about things that you were writing about?
Well, newspapers used to be pretty anonymous places, and they were about news. They weren't really about views. So I was one of the transitional people that started bringing in all sorts of abstract ideas and discussions into newspapers. I'd write about meaninglessness and religion and all sorts of odd things, and the reaction to it was quite phenomenal. So apart from giving me an interesting career, it made it possible for others to start writing personal and idiosyncratic columns as well. So it had a quite a cathartic effect on the media back in the 60s, 70s.
Absolutely. So having said all that, what do you think is the biggest misconception about you?
Oh, I love misconceptions. I encourage them. I get a bit tired of the argument that I'm totally focused on John Howard. It is true that I find the man detestable. But I would also suggest that I write about more topics than almost anyone else in the game. In a year's column writing for the Oz, I tackle hundreds of subjects. Mm. Now, as a broadcaster, I also have the best job in the country because I have an international chat show, and I can talk to anyone on earth virtually that I find interesting on any issue that intrigues. So it's the same pattern. The radio program casts the widest possible net.
Well, so you're referring to Radio National?
To Late Night Live on Radio National.
Yeah.
So in the last 15 years, I've spoken to probably 15,000 of the most influential people on earth.
Yeah.
And it's a strange feeling because I sit in the studio late at night and there's very rarely a guest sitting opposite me. Their voices in the headphones. And they can be in Moscow or New York or London or Tel Aviv or Baghdad. And the topics can be anything from philosophy to economics to culture to religion to science.
Absolutely.
So I've got a couple of good gigs that are a great privilege.
Yes, sure sounds like it. So tell me, you touched on it. I've done a bit of reading and research about yourself. Do you still not believe in God? And if not, why not?
Oh, I'm probably Australia's best known atheist, and that's been one of my points of difference, and I wrote about my disbeliefs in God from a pretty early age. I've never believed in God. I found I couldn't when I was 5, and now I'm 64, and we don't talk to each other. God doesn't believe in me either.
That can happen. Do you mind sharing if there was any particular event which led to that disbelief?
No, it wasn't. Nothing led to disbelief. Nothing led to belief.
Okay.
It wasn't a case of not believing. I could never see the sense in it. I find God a totally redundant, unnecessary, and basically silly idea. On the other hand, I passionately believe in Father Christmas and the Tooth Fairy.
There you go. So we've all got to believe in something.
Oh, absolutely.
What do you attribute most of your successes to?
I don't know. I mean, that's not something I've ever thought about, really. But I think the important thing in journalism, particularly in commentating, is to find your own voice and to have your own views on things and not simply to parrot those of others. Mm. And, of course, the function of someone like me in the media is that many people thoroughly approve of you, but equally many people loathe and detest you.
Mm.
And that's the value. That's the value you are to a media outlet.
Yes.
That you provoke hostility as much as approval.
Yes. Plenty of that going on in the media business for sure. Tommy, what mentors, if any, did you have and why?
None. I left school when I was 15, so I wasn't well educated. Can you hang on a sec?
Yes, sure. Just... Yep.
Large one? Thanks, Mario. Good on you. Sorry, they're just picking up the car.
I'll ask the question again. What mentors, if any, did you have and why?
No mentors. As I said, self-educated. Bruce Petty helped me get a job. Many years later, I helped Bruce Petty get one, so I paid that debt. But no, I've never been mentored in that sense. It's odd that I've worked for newspapers for half a century, but I rarely visit them.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been into the Australian's office 3 or 4 times in 30 years, and I'm a freelancer. I'm just out there doing what I enjoy doing, and I have to emphasise that I enjoy what I do enormously.
Yes, it's an excellent business for being in control, and the lifestyle can be phenomenal. So tell me, do you have any preference towards radio, film, print, TV, and why?
I spent 30 years building the Australian film industry up, and I made a dozen or so feature films. I walked away from that finally because I found it tedious. I hated all the money stuff involved with film. I hated having to raise the millions of dollars, and I hated having to work with vast numbers of people on a film project. I prefer to work basically alone, which is, I find, far more congenial.
Mm-hmm.
I like radio enormously because you don't have to dress up for it. I can just wander in late at night and sit down and talk to, as I said, the most interesting people on earth.
Mm.
But my first love will always be writing. Just sitting down, picking up the dictaphone and winging it, which is what I'm doing at the moment, actually. I'm writing my 2 weekly columns this morning.
Terrific, and balancing this interview at the same time, busy man.
Well, no, this is pleasure.
All right, excellent. And so tell me, why is both the ABC and the BBC so successful?
Well, around the world, people feel the need for public broadcasting because it makes a change from the proprietorially directed media. I mean, most newspapers in this country, of course, are owned by Rupert, with whom I've had a cordial relationship. I'm astonished he still employs me, given that I disagree with him and he's with me on every issue. But people finish up going to public broadcasting because they know that it's not being guided or directed or overtly influenced by a proprietor.
Mm.
And therefore, particularly in times of crisis like the current war, they recognise they're more likely to get an unbiased version of events than they are if they're looking at CNN or Fox News or reading the Daily Telegraph.
Absolutely. So back to print, what are some of the most successful books that you've authored, and what's made certain books more popular than others, would you suggest?
Well, the most successful in terms of just gross sales are the silliest books I do collections of jokes. And we sell well over 1 million copies of those, so they've been a publishing phenomenon.
Yeah.
But then I do very serious books on political issues or did a book on India, for example, on the politics and culture of India. They don't sell very well, but I greatly enjoy doing them.
Right.
So if you don't measure success in ratings, or if you do, you're mad. And you don't measure success as a writer by book sales or newspaper circulation. You measure it by, you know, what you regard as the quality of your output rather than the volume of the applause.
I understand what you're saying. Now, incorporating technology as the media's embraced more and more of it over the years, what role do you think news media websites should play?
You're now operating in a world which is best described as unmediated. The 20th century was the century of mass media, when people's perceptions of the world were mediated by the media. Now people go around it, avoid it, ignore it, or simply use it as one of the inputs, and they can wander around the world of the website, and they can inform and misinform themselves. Now the dangers of the unmediated world is that it's full of rat bags, it's full of nonsense, it's full of conspiracy theories, but it's also full of energy and curiosity, and everything can now be discovered if you really want to inform yourself. The new technologies, for the first time in history, allow you to do that. I wish more people did that and simply didn't download porn, but the technology is in place, and I watch at the moment with fascination of totally different conclusions of people on the net come to in regard to the war in Iraq.
Yes, and I guess everyone's been looking at the Al Jazeera website, and I guess by no coincidence at all, someone actually posted a picture of the American flag the other week just to try to prove a point or whatever.
It's a very important world now.
Yes.
But I think the world of media, formal mainstream media, will gradually wither and die in the next 10, 15 years as more and more people will simply switch over to the unmediated world, which is, with all its risks and dangers, is also so exhilarating.
Yes, I can see how your way of thinking would suggest that. So, some people have suggested that you may have reinvented yourself over the years. Why do you think that may be, and what's your views on that?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that. I've had lots of careers. I always had two or three at once.
Yeah.
But there's been an absolute consistency in political views all my life. That's never really shifted. But yes, for example, I had a long and quite successful career in advertising.
Yeah.
But even while I was in that, I was still involved in all the other issues and activities that I'm in today. So advertising was a sort of a detour for me rather than a principle. You know, it was how I earned money, but it wasn't what interested me.
Understood. How do you think they're actually perceived in the media business, and why, and do you care?
Well, I'm perceived by the Prime Minister as the problem with the ABC.
Yeah.
Whenever he's asked about what's wrong with the ABC, sum up in two words, which happen to be my name. Many, of course, are the right-wing commentators, and there's thousands of them. The devil incarnate. But I also, of course, I have a million listeners to the radio program, and I've probably got close to a million readers. So I've got my supporters as well as my detractors.
Absolutely. What role do you see media playing in the community, and what role should it play?
Well, in the best possible world, the media should report honestly and accurately on what's going on in the world and try to tell people why.
Yes.
Sometimes it doesn't, also often it doesn't. But the media's too big a word. It covers everything from Stanza Manic to the Washington Post. It's like the word religion, you know, it covers everything from the Roman Catholic Church to heavy evangelists raking in money from the gullible.
Yeah.
These terms finally don't mean anything unless you heavily qualify them.
Yeah, understood. What is the most significant contribution you see having given to the Australian public, particularly from a media and arts perspective?
Well, I guess it's what Barry Jones and I did in the early 70s and the late 60s, when we persuaded Gorton and then consequently Whitlam and others to crank up the Australian film industry. That would have been the single most impactful thing I brought off, that we didn't have a film industry, and then suddenly we did.
Yeah.
And most of that architectural work and the concept came from me, and most of the political pressure came from my newspaper columns.
Mm.
And we've now, as you might have noticed, got quite a big film industry as a result.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I take some pleasure in that. But I, on the other hand, I'm not at all delighted at the way the industry is now becoming more and more Americanized and
mm-hmm.
mid-Pacific. I wanted an Australian film industry.
Mm.
I don't give a stuff if we make the Matrix of Fox Studios. That's not what it was about for me.
Okay. And back to a whole world perspective. Do you think the Iraqis could actually overthrow Saddam Hussein with outside... back to global events, do you think the Iraqi people could actually overthrow Saddam Hussein without outside interference?
Given time, they would have. If the sanctions against Iraq had been lifted 10 years ago
mm-hmm.
and they'd been allowed to have a proper economy, the Iraqi middle class would have got more and more wealthy because they're pretty good at it.
Yeah.
And once that happens, once you've got an affluent middle class, despots fall over. It's the universal truth. So had the West been a little more patient and pulled the sanctions, a natural process would have occurred in which he would have been rendered redundant.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can see what happened in the Soviet bloc, for example, and in Eastern Europe. They didn't need to be invaded or bombed.
Mm.
All you had to do was allow a natural process of democratization to take place, and that's much better than killing people.
Mm. It's interesting how you've got the do-gooder sort of perspective, let's save the people at the end of the tunnel. You've got the pot of gold, or in the case over there, you've got the oil reserves. So you sort of can back up the story saying, okay, well, let's do it for the people, but maybe if there was nothing there to take, perhaps they wouldn't be so gung-ho about it.
Well, I'm not sure that oil's finally the issue, but as someone, as an American commentator pointed out, if the Iraqis' main product was broccoli, we wouldn't be in there fighting them now.
Mm, absolutely. Do you think some people may feel threatened or intimidated by you, given your attitude to just say what needs saying and just get it out there, make your opinion heard?
Oh, some might. More, I think, would be either amused or exhilarated by it, or simply angered.
Mm.
And that's part of the job, isn't it?
It is.
To be a provocateur and to get people thinking and talking about issues.
Absolutely, and you've done a terrific job at it, no doubt in the world about that. So, if you don't mind disclosing, or perhaps even giving a hint, have you ever received death threats, or basically, in colloquial terms, have you ever really, really pissed somebody off to the extent where they may have wanted to, let's say, get even in roundabout ways?
Oh, I've had tons of death threats, and not so long ago they had to evacuate the ABC. A parcel turned up which was deemed to be bomb-like.
Oh, geez.
One gets used to that. It's just, you know, part of the course.
Yeah. Wow. So, tell me, have you always been a sceptic?
Yes.
Okay.
But I think it's important to be sceptical about everything, not simply about claims of the paranormal. It's not good enough to be sceptical about a conjuring trick like bending spoons, as Uri Geller.
Yeah.
Uri Geller does. It's just as important to be sceptical, more important to be sceptical about what prime ministers and presidents tell us about the reasons for wars against Iraq, for example.
Mm, understood.
Skepticism is the healthiest of things, as distinct from cynicism, which is unhealthy.
I actually agree on that point. What media-related awards and commendations have you won, and what ones actually meant the most to you, and why?
Oh, look, I haven't won that many. I've got a few, but I've never nominated myself for any of them, so it's not a really relevant question.
Okay. I guess all the better if you don't have to nominate yourself, and you pick up things along the way just as a matter of producing good stuff. Tell me, other than John Howard, who may you despise in the Australian media or political business?
Well, I should point out that I've gone on very well with all sorts of Liberal Prime Ministers. Many of my big government jobs were given to me.
Yeah.
By John Howard's predecessors, and I've had very cordial relations with Liberal premiers and setting up things like, you know, state film centres and and so on. So it's not simply an anti-liberal thing, and I also have very hostile relations with certain Labour leaders. I'm hardly on speaking terms with Bob Hawke, and I don't think Kim Beazley's talking to me these days. So it's not a simple ideological thing about being anti-liberal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm anti a lot of people,
yep.
irrespective of their brand, you know, their political affiliations or brand names.
Mm.
Who do I despise? Well, I think that I would single out some of the shock jocks as being despicable.
Yes.
As being the lowest forms of media life.
I think some of our audience will know who we're talking about. Some of them probably don't need a name attached to them, just tune into the stations in the morning.
I think that these are pretty vile and unconscionable creatures. Many of them, of course, are totally insincere. They don't really have any belief systems of their own. They simply try to sense which way the wind is blowing and to pour petrol on social problems to make people angry and to divide.
Yes.
And that's profoundly irresponsible. I don't think I'd be terribly heartbroken if the transmission towers on 2GB and 2UE, for example, suddenly melted or toppled over. That would probably be a very healthy thing for the community.
It certainly makes a lot of changes. How would you describe the freedom of the press in Australia, or lack thereof?
Oh, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. We've got problems with defamation laws, and the real issue, of course, is the limited number of owners.
Yeah.
The real problem in Australia is that you can work for Kerry, you can work for Rupert, you can work for Fairfax, and that's about it. Whereas if we were in London, there'd be a much greater variety of prospective employers. Now, because of this, it tends to intimidate or make timid many journalists. So the biggest problem in this country isn't censorship of the media. It's self-censorship by the working journalist.
Yes.
Who thinks, well, if I say that or if I go too far, I could lose my job.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is equally applicable to people on short-term contracts at the ABC.
Yes, and for reasons like that is part of the reason we've established Media Man Australia, the website, because, you know, we just like to get the information out there and not be, binned by a local newspaper or a higher level media outlet because they don't like the message that you're putting out there.
That's the great virtue of the web.
It certainly is. What's the biggest compliment you've ever received?
Oh, I think John Howard saying that I was the problem with the ABC. It's nice to
say
that.
Yeah.
So emphatically by your political enemies.
Yeah, no, look, awesome. And what would you say is the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Not advice. I'm going to give you an aphorism
that
I think is important for anyone in media or interested in media to remember. It was given to me by a scientist when I was running something called the Commission for the Future, Barry Jones, who was the Minister for Science. At our first meeting, a visiting scientist from Britain said, "Data isn't information, information isn't knowledge, and knowledge isn't wisdom." Now think about that, because we tend to confuse data with knowledge, and they're completely different.
Mm-hmm.
Data, and there's a billion tons of it around, all the digitized data in the world, it has to be acted upon before it becomes information.
Mm-hmm.
That information has to be thought about before it's knowledge, and that's a long way from wisdom. So we live in a world where there's a ton of stuff flying around, but it doesn't make us smarter.
Understood. What are some of your most interesting current projects?
Oh, well, it's putting out four radio programs a week, which are broadcast 9 times within Australia and then go out on the web and on Radio Australia. That's fascinating and challenging and intriguing.
Yes.
It's having the privilege of having a couple of national newspaper columns.
Mm.
I'm working on 3 or 4 books, but I'm usually doing that, and a couple of documentary film projects.
Terrific. And finally, what other information would you like our audience to become aware of?
Well, I just like them to think for themselves and to seek out the information that is often elusive and hard to find.
Yes.
To think for themselves and to remain curious and sceptical. If they do, they will become much more intelligent and much more useful citizens.
wiser words have never been said. Well, Philip, thank you very much for joining us on the program today. We very much appreciate it, and we do hope there'll be a future opportunity to once again get your views on a number of topics.
A pleasure. Fine.
Thanks, Philip.